This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, September 18th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, biologists say global warming is depleting Arctic sea ice, threatening walruses and other species of the coast of Alaska. In Washington, representatives of 17 countries meet to prepare for the Copenhagen climate change talks. And we talked to a California woman who's calling on debtors to revolt against their banks.
I decided that somebody has to stand up. Why not me?
All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A U.S. appeals court has ruled that it is unconstitutional to limit the ways nonprofit groups spend and raise money to advance candidates and political agendas. The court ruled that part of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law violated free speech rights. The abortion rights group Emily's List brought the case. It now could be appealed to the Supreme Court. The U.S. Justice Department is trying to get a federal judge to throw out a case that challenges the Defense of Marriage Act. Same-sex couples in Massachusetts have challenged the federal statute, saying it's unconstitutional to deny legally married same-sex couples the same federal rights as straight couples. The DOJ acknowledges the law is discriminatory, but says it is constitutionally permissible, and until it is repealed, it must be upheld. Some good news today for community radio advocates. The FCC now appears to be firmly on the side of empowering local communities to set up low-power FM stations. FSRN's Shuhei Nakayama has more.
All commissioners on the Federal Communication Commission have approved the Local Community Radio Act, which will likely propel the expansion of low-power FM stations. Originally, Congress imposed restrictions on LPFM early in the decade, because full-power radio station owners claimed the small stations would obstruct their signals. But after a study showed LPFM does not disturb full-power stations, the FCC began asking Congress for the authority to regulate the stations. The Local Community Radio Act is now headed for final debate in the House Subcommittee on Telecommunications Technology and the Internet. Shuhei Nakayama, Free Speech Radio News.
In May, FSRN reported on Michael Randall's appointment as the new head of the Illinois Department of Corrections. Governor Pat Quinn charged Randall with implementing a reform to the state's only supermax prison, a facility targeted by activists who call it a holding cell for the mentally ill. FSRN's Ellen Pearson has this update.
Illinois' new head of corrections announced a 10-point plan to reform TAM's supermax prison, a solitary confinement facility located in the southern part of the state. Proposed changes include implementing transfer review hearings, informing prisoners of their estimated length of stay, and conducting ongoing mental health screenings of all inmates. Lori Jo Reynolds is an organizer from the group TAMS Year 10. She's pleased with the plan, but remains concerned.
What we're calling for, along with other human rights organizations, is independent oversight of mental health diagnosis and treatment to prevent the kind of neglect and abuse of mentally ill prisoners that has already been well documented at TAM.
IDOC officials will also re-examine the prison population to determine who may be eligible for transfer. A recent review resulted in 45 men being scheduled for transfer out of the Supermax. Ellen Pearson, Free Speech Radio News.
The government of Yemen has opened an investigation into an airstrike yesterday that missed its target and hit a refugee camp, killing more than 85 internally displaced civilians, most of them women and children, according to UNICEF. The Yemeni government is locked in a battle with Shiite insurgents in the northern part of the country. Rights groups have raised concern about the resulting toll on civilian populations. In Honduras, internal resistance and international pressure on the coup government has grown incredibly in the months since President Manuel Zelaya was kidnapped by the military and forcibly expelled from the country. Now there are attempts to debilitate the massive nonviolent resistance movement known as the National Front Against the Coup. From Central America, Nan McCurdy has more.
After facing accusations of militancy within their organization, the National Front Against the Coup denied the existence of any armed groups under the command of President Manuel Zelaya. In a statement to the press Thursday, the group said it only employs nonviolent methods and that those making claims to the contrary are trying to expose the group's leadership to government repression. In fact, an August report by Amnesty International denounced the, quote, increasingly disproportionate and excessive use of force by the police and military to repress legitimate and peaceful protests across the country. The large and creative resistance movement has supporters in all parts of Honduras. The front also says it will boycott the upcoming November elections if Zelaya is not reinstated as president by the end of September. Nan McCurdy, FSRN.
Today, Argentina is marking 3 years since the disappearance of a key human rights witness whose testimony led to the conviction of a former police chief for crimes committed during the nation's military dictatorship. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
Jorge Julio Lopez, a torture survivor who testified in a historic human rights trial, went missing on September 18, 2006, after leaving his home in La Plata. Lopez testified against Miguel Echecolas, and the police chief was sentenced to life in prison for committing crimes against humanity and genocide. Human rights groups suspect police and court authorities with ties to officials who participated in rights abuses for disrupting the investigation into the disappearance of Lopez. Eduardo Nachman is with the human rights group Hijos.
Julio López had the courage to identify Echecolas as a torturer. His disappearance isn't a coincidence. He was disappeared to scare off and threaten many people who must testify.
Marches are planned in Buenos Aires, La Plata, and other cities on Friday afternoon to demand an end to impunity and that López reappear alive. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
In December, world leaders will gather in Copenhagen for climate negotiations that many see as essential for slowing climate change. But before Copenhagen comes, numerous meetings are happening this week and next in Washington, D.C., New York, and Pittsburgh. Representatives from 17 countries gathered Thursday and Friday in the nation's capital to get the ball rolling. FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports.
The world's most polluting countries met at the U.S. State Department to get an early start on climate talks. Together, the 17 countries from every continent in the world except Antarctica account for 80% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions.
With such a short amount of time between now and the Copenhagen summit, it's become incredibly important that we use the G20 summit as well as the major economies forum to help put negotiations on more solid ground.
John Podesta is the president of the Center for American Progress. He and other environmental experts and activists spoke to reporters Friday at a teleconference.
Countries like China, Brazil, Mexico, and South Africa are ready to move forward with their own commitments. So we need a more constructive atmosphere where talks amongst emitters such as those can take place.
The countries gathered in Washington are addressing two of the major points of contention: how to set emissions targets and how to help developing countries finance the changes. The U.S. is carving out a very different role for itself than the last time around. The fact that the U.S. signed but never ratified the Kyoto Protocol in the late 90s is widely blamed for weakening the agreement. But Kyoto expires in 2012, and the Obama administration is taking a proactive role. The president himself brought the 17 countries together under the rubric of the Major Economies Forum on Energy and Climate. Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, who chairs the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, says the whole world is watching what the U.S. will do next.
I think it's critical that there is actual progress and a perception of progress in the U.S., because otherwise this could have an unfavorable impact, certainly on Europe. And I've talked to several European leaders. They are concerned. They have their own problems. And it could easily weaken the resolve of Europe to stand by what they've already committed.
Emerging economies like China and India have been reluctant to commit to reducing emissions. Chinese officials have said that since China is still a developing country, its priorities are to develop its economy and raise living standards. They say an increase in emissions will have to accompany economic growth, and so China would not be able to accept a binding target of emissions reductions. Former Colorado Senator Tim Wirth, now president of the United Nations Foundation, was a climate negotiator during the Clinton administration. He says despite this reticence, he expects great things from developing nations.
China is really just a totally new society and economy. It's stunning to go there. And India is moving into the renewable realm very rapidly.
However, he warns it's unrealistic to hope that all countries will commit to the same emission standards.
It's pretty clear we're not going to get a single reduction target. We're not going to get a single number that everybody agrees on. Rather, what we're going to do is have an approach where different countries will do things in a different way.
Although many have their hearts set on a Copenhagen breakthrough, observers from the Council on Foreign Relations and the Pew Center think Copenhagen will be just the start of talks that will continue into next year. Activist groups are planning demonstrations over the next weeks and months to push world leaders to take strong action in Pittsburgh and Copenhagen. The climate campaign Tick, Tick, Tick is calling for a global day of action Monday. Right now, they're expecting 500 events in 55 countries, from flash mobs to phone calls. And the Pittsburgh G20 Resistance Project is planning a march for the first day of the summit next weekend. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
The Obama administration is seeking a more integrated way of regulating the nation's lakes and marine shores. Obama's Task Force for Oceans called for the creation of a National Ocean Council that would coordinate the efforts of several agencies to conserve marine ecosystems. The council would deal with issues like fisheries, water quality, and pollution from industrial and commercial activities. It would facilitate a joint response from federal agencies that currently deal with these problems separately. In a report released yesterday, Obama's Ocean Task Force also recommended the federal government take an ecosystem-based approach to marine policy. One of the issues the new Ocean Council would look at are the impacts of global warming in coastal communities and ecosystems, like Alaska's Arctic waters, where climate change is melting the ice shelf. National Snow and Ice Data Center recently revealed that Arctic summer ice reached a minimum extension of 1.97 million square miles on September 12th, making 2009 the third lowest year on record. Shay Wolf is a biologist at the Center for Biological Diversity. She says these low levels of sea ice are having a catastrophic impact on Alaska's walruses.
You know, important point is that when the sea ice disappears from the walrus's foraging grounds and they're forced to come on shore, then it exposes them to new dangers on shore. And one of those dangers, especially for young walruses, is that they can be trampled to death in these large herds when there are stampedes. So if, for example, there's human disturbance, a human shows up, a plane flies too low, or maybe a predator shows up, walruses will stampede toward the safety of the water, and large males can crush calves.
Life specialists recently found some 200 dead walruses near Icy Cape in Alaska's northern coast. Most of them were calves and yearlings. Wolf says other species, like polar bears and four types of seals, also depend on sea ice as a breeding ground or as a base from which to hunt for fish. Over the summer, the House of Representatives passed a bill aimed at reducing carbon emissions, the American Clean Energy and Security Act, which will be discussed by the Senate later this year. Many environmentalists oppose this proposal.
The House bill, even if it were implemented and executed perfectly, wouldn't achieve the greenhouse gas reductions necessary to save the walrus, the polar bear, and the Arctic. The scientists, climate scientists, and the best available climate science are telling us that we need to achieve atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration of 350 parts per million if we're to avoid catastrophic climate impacts. The House bill wouldn't even achieve a target of 450, and we need to get down to a target of 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide.
Wolf says Congress and the Obama administration should instead focus on enforcing the Clean Air Act. She says this legislation provides the necessary tools to curb carbon emissions. You're listening to FSRN. This week marks the one-year anniversary of the demise of Lehman Brothers, an event that led to the collapse of the financial system and eventually a $700 billion taxpayer bailout. 1 year later, while many banks are making profits, many Americans are still struggling to find work and pay bills. Some of them are starting to see their bills get higher as credit card companies raise their rates. In Northern California, one resident isn't complacent with this news. Healthcare worker Ann Minch decided to stop paying her credit card debt earlier this month after she found out that Bank of America had jacked up her interest rate to 30%. She made her intentions public on a YouTube video.
"You have reaped ungodly profits in your behemoth casino scams, then lost, only to turn around and usurp the wealth of this great nation by the outright rape and pillage of middle-class Americans whose sweat and toil built it."
Minch is staging a debtor's revolt against Bank of America and other financial institutions. She says she won't pay her debt back until the bank returns her interest rates and monthly payments to their previous levels. And she's calling on U.S. citizens who feel cheated by their banks to rip up their credit cards and stop their payments. We spoke to Ann Minch earlier today.
"No problem. Glad to do it."
Now, the Bank of America jacked up your interest rates to 30%. How long had you been a customer, and had you always made your payments on time?
"I've been a Bank of America customer since 1995. I've had this particular credit card account for about 6 or 7 years. I originally had a $12,000 credit line, which they reduced to $7,000 fairly recently, and just because all the banks were doing that. They snuck my interest rate from 12.99% last December to 24.49% in January of this year. I didn't really notice that at the time, but I did get a letter in the July statement that informed me that the interest rate was now going to 30%. And that's when I got really angry, and I decided to call the bank to try and negotiate the rate back down. The customer service representative reviewed my payment history and verbally acknowledged that there had been no problems with my payment history, hadn't missed any payments, not late on any payments. When they told me the reason why they did that, it was just that now the bank's new policy."
Mm. So then that's when you decided to make your video on YouTube denouncing the bank and saying you weren't going to pay back.
Right. So I thought about it, and I thought, you know what, this whole practice just needs to stop. This is no longer just about me. This is about every American taxpayer in this country that's a bank customer. The public rallied overwhelmingly against the bank bailouts, and our representatives, not caring about what their constituents have to say, did it anyway. And now the banks are being allowed to gouge us for even more. And I decided that somebody has to stand up against this. Why not me?
Mm. And your video, you made it on September 8th. You have more than 200,000 views now. Last week you made a second video where you're talking about the 4-point plan for being a debtor's revolt soldier. Could you tell us about that?
The 4-point plan is, number one, we're calling for people to take their checking and savings accounts out of the big banks and put their money into small local community banks and credit unions, because those are the institutions that are supporting your own community that you can develop a personal relationship and rapport with and will be more likely to deal with you fairly. We have to get back to doing business with our neighbors on Main Street instead of these corporate conglomerates that really don't have Americans or their communities in their best interest. And number two, I'm encouraging people to cut up their credit cards. Don't use them anymore unless they're cards that you pay off, you know, where you pay the full balance every month. Number three, to basically downsize living. We need to get back to living more simply. Not only is it better for our pocketbooks, but it just, your life is less stressful when it's not so complicated. You know, do we all really need brand new cars and granite countertops? You know, all of these things that we spend money on for things that we really don't need. And then finally, number four, I'm encouraging people to, you know, obviously consider the personal ramifications of revolting against a creditor, i.e. your credit is probably going to be damaged in some way if you you know, stop making payments. But if you do have a creditor that's gouging you, to consider your own personal situation, and if you're willing to make the sacrifice for it, is to simply stop paying them until they give you a fair rate back. Now, I want it to be stressed that I'm not telling people to just flake out on their obligations. That's not what I'm about. You know, I'm not telling people to just completely walk away from their debt that they are obligated to, but just simply to stop making payments in protest of these usury rates and then resume making payments when and if the bank gives you a fair interest rate.
I saw a video posted on YouTube today where there's a woman saying you're her hero, even if you can't remember what your name is. What kind of response have you been receiving from the public?
Oh, it has been overwhelmingly positive. I've only had a few critics, mainly people that tell me that, well, you signed the dotted line when you opened the account, which was 6 or 7 years ago. So you knew the bank had the right to do this, so you should just eat it and pay the 30%. Well, just because the bank had the legal right to do it doesn't make it morally right and doesn't make it, you know, morally right for me to just lay down and take it. You know, I wanted to stand up not just for me, but for every American.
That was Ann Minch, a resident of Red Bluff, California. In her most recent video, Minch proposes a 4-point plan to become a debt revolt soldier. You can see it on our website, www.fsrn.org. This week, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Michael Mullen, said it's unlikely more troops would be sent to Afghanistan based on the strategy put forth by General Stanley McChrystal, who commands U.S. and NATO troops. Federal lawmakers are weighing these options in a number of hearings that began this week. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair John Kerry.
Yesterday was the first hearing. We heard three compelling cases, each of them making strong arguments individually for how America should proceed. And the prescriptions ranged from dramatically reducing the footprint to expanding our commitment of troops and money to a level that would basically constitute pretty significant nation building. John Nagel, a co-author of the military's counterinsurgency manual, worked very closely with General Petraeus, argued that victory could require as many as, according to the field manual for standard counterinsurgency operations, 600,000 troops and a commitment of at least 5 years.
As the U.S. government considers sending more troops into a conflict zone, some activists predict there could be a rise in war resistors. To learn more about a new wave of war resistors and the status of those who refused to serve under President Bush, FSRN's Mark Taylor Canfield spoke to Jerry Condon, director of the Seattle group Project Safe Haven.
Jerry Condon is the director of Project Safe Haven, a group based in Seattle. Project Safe Haven's mission is to provide support for war resistors and their families. Along with Veterans for Peace and Iraq Veterans Against the War, these organizations assist soldiers who have decided not to participate in the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. During our recent interview, I asked Jerry if he could elaborate on the military's treatment of 1st Lieutenant Aaron Watada, stationed at Fort Lewis in Washington State. Jerry, we haven't heard much recently from 1st Lieutenant Aaron Watada. He served as a very effective spokesperson for the anti-war movement for a while, and then was subjected to a military trial. We know that that first court-martial was declared a mistrial. So how is the military dealing with him now, and what is his current status?
He remains in limbo. It's been a very strange, long dance between him and the U.S. Army. It's been 2.5 years since his court-martial ended in a mistrial. Several years since he should have been discharged, the Army is still holding him hostage, essentially, at Fort Lewis.
Does anyone have a rough estimate on how many U.S. soldiers have become war resistors?
There are more and more soldiers refusing to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are tens of thousands who are AWOL. That's been the primary form of resistance to date. Several hundred of those are in Canada, and there's been a big struggle going on for several years in Canada now.
Can you give us some information on the new developments in the deportation cases in Canada?
The Prime Minister of Canada is a conservative who supported the war. Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and he's insisted on deporting resistors. So several of them have been deported over the last few months, have come back to the United States, been court-martialed, and been in prison for 15 months and for a year. And about half dozen now are fighting imminent deportation from Canada. Recently, Kimberly Rivera, the first woman soldier from the U.S. to seek sanctuary in Canada, and also an Iraq veteran, was on the verge of deportation along with her husband and three young children. She won a very important federal court case that's going to give her more time to make her case. Essentially, the federal court judge said that the government authorities who are responsible had not taken into account the fact that war resistors in the U.S. who are outspoken are the ones who are getting the highest sentences. An average AWOL returning to custody by either being captured or turning themselves in will oftentimes be discharged or reintegrated into the unit or given a relative slap on the hand. That's often the case. But those who have been public have been consistently sentenced to significant prison terms of a year and more. Kimberly Rivera's lawyer made that case, but it was ignored, and now they're going to have to reconsider her situation, so she has a chance of staying. And if she does win that, it'll be a very significant victory for all the war resistors there.
Are there any other war resistor cases that you think people should be paying attention to right now?
Another young man, Rodney Watson, who's an Iraq veteran, is in Vancouver, B.C. He's been ordered deported, got a little bit of a reprieve, and he's still considering his options, but he may well be forced across to the U.S. In the near future. And I think, you know, we in the U.S. Can continue to support these war resistors in Canada, and then once these folks are deported to the U.S., it's our responsibility, those of us who believe in peace and justice and want to support these war resistors, have to come to their defense and raise money for their legal support, bring political support, attend their court martials. If they are imprisoned, to support them while they're in prison, write them letters, etc., keep connected with them. There are also soldiers in the U.S. who've chosen, instead of fleeing military custody, to stand up, like Lieutenant Watada did, and say, I don't believe in this illegal war. I'm not going. I'll fight it right here. An Iraq veteran named Victor Agosto, who was now being ordered to go to Afghanistan, publicly refused. He got a lot of political support, so much so that the military seemed to kind of trip over themselves in their prosecution of him, and they ended up having to proceed with a summary court-martial. And although they convicted him, they could only give him 30 days because that's the maximum sentence for a summary court-martial. Most of the other war resistors are either getting a special court-martial, which can give a maximum year, or a general court-martial, which can give years. And then another person in his unit, Travis Bishop, is being court-martialed, I think, in the coming days or weeks, somebody from the same unit who's taken the same stand.
That was FSRN's Mark Taylor Canfield speaking to Jerry Condon, director of Project Safe Haven in Seattle. You can listen to the full interview on our website, fsrn.org. And that's all for today's program. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. And our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.